Good morning. My name is Greg Millett. I am in the Office of National AIDS Policy, and I'm extremely happy to see everybody that we have gathered in the room today. Thank you for accepting the invitation to come to the White House meeting on Black Men and HIV. Before we get started, I just wanted to take care of a few housekeeping details very quickly, is that we have the women's restrooms outside this door and to the right-hand side. And for the men's restrooms, you can go outside this door, either to the left or to the right, and you'd be able to find them. Thank you.
Good morning. My name is Jeffrey Crawley, and I'm the Director of the Office of National AIDS Policy, and it's my pleasure to welcome you here today to the White House. Before I begin, let me tell you that we're recording today's event as a C-SPAN, so I just wanted to let you know that. So we're looking forward to today's discussion. We believe that this is actually the first time there's been a meeting at the White House looking at issues around HIV and black men, so we think it's an important first step. All the work that I do is really undergirded by, I just have the best team around in the Office of National AIDS Policy, and they all do many things, but I'd like to in particular acknowledge Greg Millett, who just said hello. He is our senior policy advisor, and he's really pulled this meeting together, and you'll hear more from him later today. But I'd also like to acknowledge that this meeting really came together with our colleagues in the Office of Public Engagement, and so this includes Michael Blake, Paul Montero, and Will Juwando. So we thank them for their partnership in holding this meeting. Now, as you know, or hopefully you all know, we've been working on the development of a national HIV/AIDS strategy. And addressing the HIV epidemic among black Americans is a critical part of what we're doing. And so we think today's meeting will be really important. We're getting close to when we'll have that strategy. We're talking a few weeks, and then our job won't be done. We'll go from there to implementation phase. So we're excited about how far we've come, but we have a lot of work collectively to keep moving forward to get a lot done. This meeting is part of a series of other meetings we've held to inform our strategy development process. We started out and we held meetings looking at issues around HIV in youth. We held issues looking at HIV in women, issues around housing. A couple weeks ago, we held a meeting with the business and philanthropic communities looking at public-private partnerships because we know we can't do this work alone. So this is just the next in a series of meetings, and once the strategy is out, we'll continue. There's lots more issues that we think merit a close examination. So we think today's meeting is really important for really four reasons. Two-thirds of HIV/AIDS cases among black Americans are among men, so it's obviously an important target population. Black, gay, and bisexual men represent the largest portion of AIDS cases in the black community, so it's important to spotlight them. But while we appropriately focus on gay men and we focus on black women who we know are disproportionately impacted among all women, sometimes we also have to recognize that straight black men get ignored and sort of get overlooked in the conversation. So we think this is an opportunity to really have an honest dialogue, and we hope this can be an inclusive dialogue that doesn't pit gay versus straight, but really comes together to start a community conversation, but really a national conversation about how we can sharpen our response both within black America, but really within the whole country to the epidemic. So we're really just eager to hear from you and learn from you today, and so I'd like to welcome you. Now it's my pleasure to introduce Michael Stoutmanis. He's the Chief of Staff to the Assistant to the President for Intergovernmental Affairs and Public Engagement. And, you know, Mike has been around a long time. He's one of these people that's had actually a long-standing relationship with the President, but he works closely with Valerie Jarrett, and we're just glad that he could be here. Now, I have to tell you that in this administration, clearly the President cares deeply about HIV and AIDS. And you'll hear from my boss later, Melody Barnes, who's the President's Domestic Policy Advisor, and she's a strong ally. But even if you sort of look outside of that, across this administration, I found just a lot of people really care deeply, even in places you wouldn't always think. But, you know, one of the challenges of the jobs we have is that, you know, I care a lot about a lot of issues that I don't always have time to deal with. You know, so when people stop and they focus on an issue, it really tells you something. And really standing out above all others in the administration are two people, and that's Mike and Valerie Jarrett, who time and time again have just really sort of stepped forward and said they want to support our efforts. You know, and when Mike is proactive and says, you know, we really care about this, anything I can do, just let me know, he really sinks in that he means it. And so when we started planning this meeting, it was really important that we said, of course we have to get him here. So I'm really glad to welcome Mike Stoutmanis.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you, Jeff. That was a really kind introduction. I appreciate that. And I appreciate, Jeff, all your hard work. You and also the Office of National AIDS Policy. Thank you for your hard work. I really am pleased to be a part of this meeting on Black men and HIV. And I just wanted to stop by and tell you to thank you for participating and to reiterate what Jeff said, that we really need your ideas. We want this to be a dialogue, and we want your full and active participation. I am so proud to work for a president who is committed to refocusing public attention on the domestic HIV/AIDS epidemic and holding meetings like this to engage all Americans in this important conversation. So you know the big numbers. At some point in their life, approximately 1 in 16 Black men will be diagnosed with HIV. The rate of new HIV infections for Black men is about 6 times as high as that of white men, nearly 3 times that of Hispanic men, and more than twice that of Black women. So these numbers are not just abstract numbers for us. Like anywhere else in America, there are those of us here in the White House who are personally affected by or infected with HIV. I first started to pay attention and focus on the issue of Black men and HIV when I was in college. I was a theater major in college. That's not going to surprise those of you in the audience who know me well. I came across a playwright named Cheryl West. She wrote a play called Before It Hits Home, which is about a bisexual African-American man who contracted HIV/AIDS. And I'm going to read a little bit from a review of that play. It is an authentic, at times almost hysterical, wake-up call to the Black community, sounded from within. What Ms. West reveals is an isolated, segregated world in which the specter of AIDS, horrible as it is in itself, is compounded exponentially by a mass psychosis of denial. In the play's most tumultuous scenes, Wendell, that's the character that I played, belatedly discloses his illness to his mother and father only to discover that these nominally loving parents respond with abject incredulity and rage. There is simply no place for AIDS in mom's conservative gospel and dad's rigid ethos of machismo. To them, the disease simply cannot exist and therefore need not be fought. That play was written in 1989. And so to see both how far we've come in 2010, to be in the White House, to hold this meeting, to be able to speak about these issues, be able to address these issues openly and in partnership is something I need to recognize. But to think about how far we've come, how far we need to go in our communities to get rid of the stigma, the denial, so that we can come together and focus on these issues, on saving lives, on helping one another, on truly being our brother and our sister's keeper. That's what this meeting and that's what our work here is all about. So Jeff mentioned this national HIV/AIDS strategy, which ONAP, I've been a year and a half now in the federal government, and so I'm starting to get these acronyms down. ONAP has been hard at work, and this is one of the president's top HIV/AIDS policy priorities. Given the staggering HIV infection rates among African Americans, addressing HIV in the Black community is integral to ending the U.S. epidemic. But we know that solving this epidemic doesn't just fall on the federal government alone. We need Americans engaged on all levels of government, as well as a committed private sector and leadership from people living with HIV and the affected community. This is why we brought you all here, to have a frank and honest discussion about federal and community responses to the epidemic and what can be done to reduce HIV stigma in the Black community. Thank you for your dedication and your courage. So at this point, I think I'll turn this program over to staff member Greg Millett, who will give everyone an epidemiological, I have my doctors here looking at me, shaking their head, overview of the HIV epidemic in the Black community and among Black men. Thanks once again for being part of this important discussion.
Thank you, Chris.
morning. Just waiting for this to open. Okay, here we go. Before we started the meeting, I thought that it would be important for us to have a common baseline of what is taking place in the United States in terms of African Americans in HIV. There's an awful lot of epidemiological data that's been out there, but one thing that we've encountered during our community discussions last year is that we heard a lot of different things about how people thought HIV was affecting African Americans. And we thought it would be appropriate to first start about what's taking place on the national level, and then I'll be followed by Dr. Shannon Hader, who is here from the D.C. Department of Health, who will talk about what's taking place here in Washington, D.C. among African American men. So briefly, to take a look at epidemiological overview of HIV among black men. Now, we know that for the past 30 years of the epidemic, that HIV has ravaged black communities all across the world, and particularly in sub-Saharan Africa, where we see that black faces are the face of the epidemic. There are 32 million people living with HIV worldwide, but about two-thirds of those people who are HIV positive reside in Saharan Africa, even though sub-Saharan Africa represents only 10% of the population. And most of those who are infected as well in sub-Saharan Africa are women, not men. In the United States, we also know that the face of HIV has also become increasingly black as well. We know that there are about 1.1 million people who are living with HIV, about half of whom are African American in the United States. And these are data from CDC in a slide that I know a lot of people in this room are already acquainted with, where we just track the epidemic in proportions of HIV/AIDS cases from 1985 through 2006. And you can see that African Americans have overtaken whites as well as Latinos since 1994 in the proportion of AIDS cases that are reported annually. Now, one of the other important things that we should take a look at in terms of the HIV epidemic in the United States is how much the epidemic in black communities is really akin or similar to what we're seeing in many African countries. This is a slide here showing the epidemic for black men in Washington, D.C., as well as blacks in Newark, New Jersey, and black communities in New York City. And you can see for black men in Washington, D.C., that the prevalence rates are just as high as among adults in Kenya. For blacks in New Jersey, that the prevalence rates are as high as those that you see in Rwanda, Burundi, as well as Nigeria. And then for blacks in New York City, you find again that the prevalence rates in those communities are as high as what we're seeing in Rwanda, Burundi, and Nigeria. So what we're seeing internationally is being played out here domestically, and it's being played out within our community. Now, these data were already talked about by Stroud a little bit earlier in terms of the lifetime risk of HIV diagnosis. And you can see for Latinos that the lifetime risk is 1 in 35 for men, 1 in 114 for women. For whites, it's 1 in 104 for men and 1 in 588 for women. Whereas for African Americans, 1 in 30 black women in their lifetime can expect an HIV diagnosis. And 1 in 16 black men can expect an HIV diagnosis. CDC also released data several years ago about number of new infections that are taking place annually in the United States, and this is really a landmark moment. It's incredible for us to actually get a snapshot of the epidemic and the number of new infections and where the epidemic is going. And one of the things that we were able to also take a look at with the data that CDC released was to see by number which communities were becoming infected with HIV. And what you can see very clearly here is that of those nine groups that are hardest hit with HIV in descending order, that gay and bisexual men still comprise the largest proportion of those cases. The first four bars that you see in the histogram, we have white gay men, black gay and bisexual men, as well as Latino gay and bisexual men. But we also see that black women are in the mix there as well. So in terms of HIV in the black community, the largest number of cases that we're seeing annually in terms of new infections are among black gay men, followed by black women. And part of the reason why we wanted to have this meeting is because when you take a little bit look down the line, you see that black heterosexual men are also represented. They're about the fifth largest. And then you see black men who are injection drug users. And then last, black female IDUs. And part of the reason that we wanted to have this meeting is because black gay men are, some of them, are the ones who are also infecting some of these heterosexual black women. And some of the heterosexual black men that we see a little farther down the line are also infecting heterosexual black women. So part of this meeting is to not only talk about what's taking place among black gay men, but also what's taking place among black heterosexual men, and that we need to take a look a little farther upstream. When we take a look at HIV among black women, we can't just look at one half of the partnership. A lot of these women are becoming infected because of the risk behaviors of their male partners. And until we address the risk behaviors of their male partners, we're not going to be able to stem the epidemic among black women as well. And also, when we take a look in the black community at the mode of transmission between 2004 and 2007, and these are CDC data, and these are among black men, you find that injection drug users, there are about close to 2,000 cases that are reported each year, estimated number of cases each year. And for heterosexuals, there are about 3,000 cases of heterosexual black men who are have HIV each year. When we take a look at men who have sex with men, you have anywhere from a little bit over 6,000 to close to 8,000 between 2004 and 2007, estimated number of HIV/AIDS cases for black, gay, and bisexual men in the community. So again, you can see that the proportion of HIV cases among black, gay, and bisexual men is disproportionate in the African-American community. And unfortunately, it doesn't stop there. The data that I showed you was just looking at black adults generally. You find exactly the same pattern when you look at black youth. And these are black youth that include black women. And these are data from 2001 through 2005, where you can see the number of black youth who are infected with HIV who are injection drug users, those who are heterosexual, as well as those who are gay and bisexual men. And again, you can see that the number of cases among gay and bisexual men, particularly between 2004 and 2005, overtakes those black youth who are infected through injection drug use or heterosexual sex. And unfortunately, CDC has worse data for young black gay men. They find that among young gay men, that black gay men have a higher incidence of HIV, as well as a higher prevalence of HIV. They're more likely to become infected, a greater proportion of them, at younger ages compared to white or Latino gay men. And when you take a look at the age cohort and what type of effect this is having in the black community, you could see that for those young black gay men between the ages of 15 and 22, 15% of them are infected in five of the major cities in the United States. For those between the ages of 23 and 29, a third are infected with HIV. And for those who have a median age of about 32, half of black gay men in major cities are infected. There is no other group in our community that has this many infections. Could you imagine saying that we have half of black women, half of injection drug users who are African American who are infected? We have half of black gay men who are infected in our cities. And when we take a look at these infection rates, we also find that many of these men who are infected, about two-thirds, don't realize that they're infected with HIV, which is another issue that we need to confront. There are also differences between black gay men and black bisexual men. I'm going to show a couple of slides here that have MSMW, that means men who have sex with men and women. And these are data that were published by Daryl Wheeler a couple of years ago. Really important study, which found that for black bisexual men, that most of them identify as bisexual. For black gay men, most of them identify as gay. When we take a look at HIV testing, we have high numbers of HIV testing for both black bisexual men as well as black gay men, about 84% and 92%. But black gay men are still more likely to test compared to black bisexual men. In terms of HIV testing, though, and the results of the HIV test, you find that black bisexual men are more likely to test HIV negative compared to black gay men. And this is something that you see in study after study, that men who are bisexually active are less likely to test positive for HIV compared with men who are gay. And in terms of some of the risk behaviors, the number one risk behavior for contracting HIV, which is unprotected anal receptive sex, you find that black gay men are more likely to engage in that activity compared to black bisexual men. So the reason that I'm showing this slide is because there's been an awful lot of dialogue about the down low over the last 4 to 5 years and the degree to which they might be associated with HIV infections in the black community. But what you can see from these data, as well as data from many other studies, is that black bisexual men do not engage in greater rates of risk behavior compared to black gay men. And they're also less likely to be HIV positive. There's another study that Jennifer Laube published several years ago taking a look at black bisexual men and trying to see whether or not there are any differences between black bisexual men who said that they were HIV negative, black bisexual men in a study who said that they were HIV positive, and black bisexual men who said that they didn't know their HIV status. And what we found in the study is that black bisexual men who said that they were HIV negative or didn't know their HIV status were more likely to report unprotected sex with a female partner who they didn't know their status or a female partner who was negative. They were also more likely to report unprotected sex with a male partner who was negative or they didn't know their status. So you're finding that black bisexual men who say that they're positive are more likely to protect their partners who don't have HIV. And to go a little further in the study, and these data were fairly shocking, is that we were only looking at these men based upon their self-reported HIV status. When we actually tested them, we found some surprising results. Those black bisexual men who said that they were HIV positive, not surprisingly, 100% of them when we tested them were HIV positive. Those black bisexual men who said that they were HIV negative, 6% were HIV positive. Now, why that's important is I was telling you that HIV negative men were engaging in unprotected sex with female partners and with male partners. And for those black bisexual men who did not know their HIV status, a whopping 40% of them were HIV positive when we tested them. So when we take a look at some of these stereotypes about black bisexual men, we have to realize that not the whole black bisexual male community is engaging in the same types of risk behaviors. That is primarily black bisexual men who don't know their HIV status, as well as black bisexual men who say that they're negative, who are engaging in unprotected sex with both male partners as well as female partners. And last, we did a study taking a look at the whole issue of the down low and trying to take a look at those men who said that they identified with the down low and correlated it with their risk behavior. And this is a study that we published in AJPH a couple of years ago. And what we did is we had about a sample of 1,000 black men, about 361 who said that they identified as down low and about 800 who said that they didn't. And we examined three risk behaviors: those who reported unprotected insertive anal sex with a man, unprotected receptive anal sex with a man, and any unprotected vaginal or anal sex with a woman. And essentially what we found is that there was no differences between those men who identified as DL and those men who did not identify as DL in terms of their unprotected sex activities with men or women. So down low, or identifying as down low, wasn't predictive of engaging in greater risk behavior, as many people assumed. And more importantly, when we just looked at those men who were HIV positive, again, we found no differences in risk behavior for those men who identified as down low and those men who didn't identify as down low. The other thing that I wanted to address other than the down low is some of the myths that we have about imprisonment in the United States. We have a rate of imprisonment that has really skyrocketed between 1925 and 2002, as you can see from this slide. So between 1920 and 1980, the rate of imprisonment in the United States was fairly stable. And then from the 1980s through today, it really spiked, two or threefold compared to where it had been for decades earlier. And it's no surprise that when we take a look in prisons, that we know that about 1 in 99 adults in the United States are imprisoned, and that the incarceration rates are different between black men, white men, as well as Latinos. For white men, it's about 1 in 106 of the population. For Latino men, it's about 1 in 36. And for black men, we're 1 in 15 represented in correctional facilities. And for those black men between the ages of 20 and 34, we are 1 in 9 who are in correctional facilities. So even though black men are 13% of the U.S. population, we account for 40% of prison inmates. And 1/3 of black men between the ages of 20 and 29 are under correctional supervision. So what does this mean in terms of HIV infection? Well, approximately 35 to 47,000 HIV-positive people are in prison or jail in the United States, and we know that that's higher than the general population, about 8 times higher than the general population. And in 1997, at least 1 of every 5 persons living with HIV in the United States passed through a correctional facility. So we know that there are a lot of people living with HIV in correctional facilities. We also know that there has been documented by CDC the spread of HIV, transmission of HIV, within a correctional facility. There was data from an outbreak that took place in Georgia that was released several years ago. However, one thing that we do know as well is that most inmates with HIV enter prison already infected, whether they know it or not. So even though transmission does take place within prisons, most of the people who are there who are HIV positive were positive before they entered prison. However, where some of the issues are is what happens in terms of release after prison. We know that HIV-positive individuals engage in behaviors that increase incredibly that they can transmit HIV to their partners right after prison. This is a study of 64 recently released HIV-positive prisoners where they found that 47% of them reported having sex since being released, and being released within the last 6 months. 26% of those men reported unprotected sex with their regular partners, and these were men who are heterosexual. And of those men who reported unprotected sex with their regular partners, a third, 33%, reported unprotected sex with their HIV-negative female partners. So we know that one of the places that we need to focus on is among those HIV-positive individuals who are just being released from prison to make sure that we can reduce their risk behavior. Because we know that as soon as they're released from prison, those risk behaviors increase. And we also know that there are effects of incarceration that take place in the Black community outside of incarcerated individuals altogether. When we have so many Black men who are being incarcerated, it really messes up the ratio between both Black men and Black women on the outside. So ideally, we'll have a ratio of 1-to-1 of females to men in the outside. And right here, I have Rashad and Tamika, where Rashad is HIV positive, Tamika is HIV negative. If we had a 1-to-1 ratio, Tamika would become positive, but we wouldn't see mass transmission of HIV necessarily. When we have a 3-to-1 ratio, though, of females to males, because there's so many Black men who are in prison, there are far more Black women for Black men to date on the outside. So in the same scenario, you have Rashad with Tamika, Erica, and Lisa. And Rashad, being HIV positive, could easily transmit HIV to both Lisa, Tamika, as well as Erica. So the fact that we have this ratio that's completely imbalanced on the outside makes it easier for concurrent partnerships in the Black community. And you see this quite a bit, where African-American men will have multiple female partners. And if that man is HIV positive, then it certainly has serious consequences for the spread of HIV in our community. One of the other last things that I wanted to talk about as well is a lot of people try to say that there's something wrong or inherently happening in the Black community as to why we see such high rates in our community. And that's not necessarily true, because for the most part, we don't engage in higher risk behaviors compared to people in other communities. And these are data of young Black heterosexuals that was published several years ago, where the top bars, the top blue and red bars, are among whites, and the top red bar and the bottom red bars are among African Americans. And the blue squares represent people who engaged in low-risk behavior and were HIV negative or did not have an STD. The red squares represent those people who, once they were tested, had an STD. And what you can see on the top among whites is that those individuals who didn't engage in a lot of risk once they were tested, they didn't have an STD or HIV. But for the red squares among whites, those people who engaged in higher rates of risk behavior, once you tested them, they had HIV or an STD. Now take a look at the bottom for African Americans. You notice that everything is red. So no matter what African Americans did, if we engaged in low risk or if we engaged in high risk, we were still more likely than the whites in this study to have STD or an HIV. And part of the reason of this is some of the social and sexual networks that takes place in our community that makes it more likely for us to encounter people who are HIV positive or have an STD compared to people in other communities. Now, this is my last slide. Given all of the HIV that we have in our community and some of the issues that we have facing our community, the really scary thing is to see the percentage of people who say that they've heard about HIV/AIDS recently and how much it's fallen in the Black community. Back in 2004, about 62% of us said that we've heard a lot about HIV and AIDS. Now, in 2009, only about a third of people reported in this Kaiser survey that they heard about HIV and AIDS. And we know that that's a travesty, given some of the numbers that I just showed to you a little bit earlier, that we have to raise awareness again within the African-American community. Now, I'd like to invite Shannon Hader to come up and discuss the DC epidemic.
Good morning, everybody. Wow. Well, we love this opportunity to be able to give just a really local snapshot of what's happening in our city of D.C. Because as much as we appreciate the national data, when you drill it down to a small urban area, 600,000 people, 64 square miles, extremely small and interconnected and overlapping social and sexual networks, the picture gets more dramatic. And also, in order to find responses, we really have to understand some of the details that are happening here and now. So I'm going to mostly quickly go through just some of the snapshots of what we know about HIV here in DC. And then I'm going to close, very non-traditionally for me, with a couple of completely anecdotal observations. So this is a quick overview of our HIV/AIDS surveillance data. So the snapshot of people living in the district who have been diagnosed and are living with HIV and AIDS. And overall, we say we have a modern epidemic, modern in both its scale and its complexity. Overall, 3.2% of all adults and adolescents living in the district right now have already been diagnosed and are living with HIV. This gives rates of 2% or higher in 7 out of 8 of our wards. So it's not just isolated to one little part of our city or the other. It's really a very, we're one big hotspot, And as I go through, you'll see that our numbers are somewhat distinctive compared to even other big cities. But what I'll propose is, we're a small town. We're one big city. We're one big hotspot. But a lot of other large urban areas, particularly in the Northeast and the South, big cities, have hotspots, oftentimes multiple hotspots within their overall city that reflect a lot of the same dynamics and a lot of the same issues that I'm going to highlight here today. So, for example, New York City doesn't have an overall HIV rate of 3.2%. But if you take a snapshot of the Bronx or parts of the Bronx, they're going to look very similar to what we look here. It just gets diluted by the huge volume and the diversity of that city overall. So, also highlighted here, again, we're a little small town. We're 55% African-American community, but 75% of all of our living HIV/AIDS cases are African-American, so we do see racial health disparities. And this is how this breaks down when we actually calculate rates by race and gender. So overall, and I'm sorry it's not real clear here, 4.7%, so almost 5%, 4.7% of our black community in the city have already been diagnosed and are living with HIV. 2% of our Latino community and nearly 2% of our white community. Break that down further, including gender, and you see essentially black women, white men, Latino men, and black men all have rates close to 3% or higher. And of course, our topic for today, black men, 7.1% of the black men in our city today have already been diagnosed and are living with HIV. And these are the rates that Greg highlighted earlier and compared to our rates in other, less developed countries. So what do we know in terms of mode of transmission? Actually, I'm going to go back for a little bit. Clearly, three of those categories, white men, Latino men, black men, these are men. Actually, when we break down by risk and mode of transmission, it's almost an 80-60-40 breakdown, with 80% of the cases among white men being among men who have sex with men. 60% of the HIV cases among Latino men being among men who have sex with men, and 40% of the HIV cases among black men being among men who have sex with men. So it's not exactly equal. There's a lot of different dynamics going on. And this just breaks down a little bit further. The modes of transmission for black men compared to all men, including black men, overall, and specifically about 40% or 42% of black men cases are attributable to heterosexual transmission, about 20% related to injection drug use, which is higher than the overall proportions among men, and still about, 40% MSM, of course, 20% IDU, and close to 20% heterosexual. This shows for black men in the city, age at which they are diagnosed and current age now. So approximately, the black men are most likely to be diagnosed in their 30s with HIV, with still a lot being diagnosed in their 40s and some being diagnosed in their 20s. That is a little bit younger than among our white men, but it's a little bit older than among our Latino men. But we look at current age now, which tells us not just about prevention, but what are the services and healthcare services that people are going to need now and over time. And you notice nearly all of our black men currently living with HIV/AIDS in the district are, you know, over 40. They're in their 40s and their 50s with 10% over 60. So again, something to think about in terms of the details of what we need to address, the services, and where we need to find people. And then similar to the overall distribution I showed you, this is just the numbers of HIV-positive black men diagnosed by geographic breakdown. And you'll notice, again, about 7 out of 8 of our wards have high numbers of HIV-positive men. We are now able to learn a little bit more about also what's going on. Now that we're promoting in D.C., real ramp up of routine HIV testing and expanding the number of people who are getting tested and hoping to try to diagnose people earlier with a real focus on linkage to care, are we having any success? So D.C. really started expanding its testing program and its linkage to care about mid-year 2006. And the gray bars here are the proportion of folks who have been at least linked to care, maybe not retained to care, but linked to HIV care after diagnosis within 3 months. And so we have made improvements within 2008, and we expect this to change a little bit after data delays are taken care of. But in 2008, about 64% of black men were linked to care within 3 months. Now, that's still a little bit lower than our overall average. For D.C., about 67% of people overall are linked to care within 3 months. So we still have a ways to go. Likewise, are we getting folks diagnosed earlier in the course of their disease? One of the things we look at is CD4 count at time of first diagnosis. And, you know, back before we started expanded testing, average CD4 count among black men at first diagnosis was about 200, so an AIDS diagnosis. Well, in the first 2.5 years of expanded testing, that's gone up. And you see in 2008, the average CD4 count at first diagnosis among black men was 300, which we're really excited to see. That said, the average CD4 count at first diagnosis among everybody in the city was 340. So we still have a disparity there. We still have further to go. And then finally, one of the things we can look at is also related to both early diagnosis, linkage to care, appropriate treatment, which is progression of disease. So amongst folks who are newly diagnosed with HIV, how many progress to AIDS within 12 months of diagnosis? Because those are huge missed opportunities. As much as HIV is a preventable disease in terms of transmission, AIDS in this day and age should be a nearly preventable condition. Because if people are linked with the appropriate care and treatment options and the appropriate support to make those successful, they don't need to go on to develop AIDS. So, have we made some progress as well? Yes, we think yes. So the light blue bars show the proportion of folks who progress from an HIV diagnosis to AIDS within 12 months. And you see we've gone from about 55% in 2003 to about 33% in 2007. We still got a ways to go. We like that to be, you know, less than 5%. So that's all been surveillance data, which is just our snapshots of people who have been diagnosed and reported with HIV in the city. We are fortunate to be part of CDC's National HIV Behavioral Surveillance Project, which gives us not just the what or the snapshot that the surveillance data gives us, but some of the why. It gives us some of the first examples of taking a vulnerable population and not only testing everybody for HIV, so we're not just looking at people who've already been diagnosed, but also asking questions about sexual behaviors, relationships, all those kind of things. So cycle number one was a heterosexual survey, and this was the methodology looked at specifically people who had any sex with a member of the opposite sex in the last 12 months, so you didn't have to say you were straight, nothing like that, and who also lived in areas or were socially connected to areas of both high HIV rates and also high poverty rates. So, and those red circles show you which areas of our city that we sampled, which really covers 6 out of the 8 wards, actually. So what do we find? We had about 750 participants, average age 36, which is good for our epidemic, given our age breakdown, a little more women than men. And overall, the HIV rate among persons in this community were 5.2%, with higher rates among women, 6.3%, than among men, 3.9%. But still, high rates of HIV among men, and these were pretty much, this was a largely black sample, so 92% African American. So it's, you know, we're able to say this is a fairly good indicator of what was happening among the heterosexual community, and particularly a heterosexual African American community. Also importantly, about half of the people who participated who were positive didn't know they were positive until they took this study. So a lot of folks who don't know they're positive can't take prevention measures to keep from transmitting. So we asked a little bit more. We asked about behaviors. Turns out amongst this group of, you know, 36-year-old heterosexually active persons with a high rate of HIV in the community tested, only about 30% had used a condom last time they had sex. Only about 50% said they had any idea or thought they knew what their partner's HIV status was. But you're in a setting with high rates of HIV. Second thing we asked about was about concurrent partnerships, and one of the things that Greg sort of talked about in his talk. So we asked folks, okay, 75% were in a regular committed relationship. So we asked them, we said, what are the chances that your partner, your regular partners, had another partner in the last 12 months? And about 42% of women, or 42% of men and 47% of women, so about 45% of men and women both, said, yeah, I'm pretty sure or positive that my partner's had other partners outside the relationship while we've been together. And then we flipped around and we said, and how about you? Have you been doing that? And we got about the same response. About 40% of women and 50% of men said, yeah, and me too. So I use this to highlight, because I think particularly also when we're talking about what Greg showed about men coming back from incarceration, we oftentimes only talk about the HIV-positive men when they come back. But what about the HIV-negative men who potentially their partners had other sex partners and other concurrent relationships? It's not just men who have concurrent relationships. And they don't necessarily have a risk perception that they're coming back into an environment with a 5% HIV positivity rate. We have done a very bad job, I think, of including HIV negative men in what we need to provide them for information, for skills building, for successful and hopefully healthy reentry into a highly affected community as well. So, next year we did the next cycle, which is the behavioral survey among men who have sex with men. And this is a different method. So this was a site-based or venue-based sampling method. And what we got in this method is we had about 500 men, I'm gonna say gay men, because they were almost all gay identified. So 500 gay men, about half white and about half men of color. I think it was about 35 or 40%, or about 40% specifically black men. And these were a wealthy, educated group, okay? 98% had high school or greater. Most people had a lot of college. A lot of people had graduate degrees. Over half made, I think, $80,000 a year or more. So this was not a socioeconomically marginalized population. What did we find? Well, we found things that were a little bit different, actually, than the previous five-city study that we weren't a part of. Overall, in this sample, 14% of the men tested HIV positive. And actually, nearly half, 40%, also didn't know they were positive until they took this study. So even though it was a highly educated, highly engaged, highly resourced group of gay men, a lot of people still didn't realize that they were HIV positive. But we also saw some really important differences. When we looked at MSM of color versus white MSM, the rates were markedly different. So MSM of color, 20% were HIV positive versus 7.7% for white MSM. When we looked at only black MSM, it was 25% HIV positivity rate. So again, we have a dramatic and really important problem to deal with. So then we looked at risk behaviors and sort of keep in mind what we saw in the heterosexual survey. And so, you know, we actually saw more safer behaviors than we saw amongst the heterosexual group, which is good because the rates in this group were three times as high as the rates in the heterosexual group, but probably not, you know, safe enough given that dramatic 14 to 25% positivity rate. So 60% said they'd used a condom last time they had sex, and about 65% said they were They thought they knew their last partner's HIV status. So those are good. Those are better than we've seen in other populations, but they're not good enough given the dramatic and severe nature of the epidemic in this community. Then we also looked at condom use or safer sex during last anal intercourse for these men. And what I'd like to highlight is looking at MSM of color versus white MSM. 66% of the MSM of color reported safer sex last time they had sex, and only 46% of the white MSM reported safer sex last time we had sex. And when we looked at a lot of the rest of the measures within the survey, you know, our local data, you know, showed what Greg alluded to as well, is despite lower levels of individual risk behaviors among the men of color and the black men, they had higher rates of HIV. So social networks, risk perception, all those kind of things really are important to bring into play. Our next cycle is the IDU cycle, and this is all completed, and unfortunately I don't have data for you yet, but it will be out this year. So there's the sort of snapshot of really what we're dealing with here in DC that I think some other urban areas are dealing with within their own hot spots within their city. And I'm going to just close with something I don't usually do for people who know me, which is a little bit of opinion or observation that just comes from in my personal experience presenting a lot of these data. And a couple of weeks ago, I had to develop a talk on this kind of stuff for a completely general audience, which is unusual to me. It was one of these TED Talks, and, you know, I was going to be sandwiched in between, you know, Alexandra Cousteau talking about saving the oceans of the world and Craig of Craigslist talking about customer service. So it's a captive audience of people who didn't come to hear about HIV, didn't come to hear about data, and that made it really sort of unique to me because I have a, you know, we're a small neighborhood here. We're a small community. I have the opportunity to talk to many different expert and non-expert groups within our community that, you know, church leaders or kids or HIV providers, but all of them come knowing what I'm going to talk about, right? So it's a little bit different. So I was thinking, so how am I going to, you know, between Craig and Alexandra, talk to this general crowd? And I said, well, you know, I'm presenting the data, but I thought about it and I said, you know, the other thing I'm going to talk about, though, is the reactions I get to these data when I present them across different groups, you know, different groups in DC, some of whom are expert HIV groups, but many of whom aren't, but are informed, engaged, passionate, invested individuals and leaders, and, you know, everything from, you know, the community advisory boards of NPR to church leaders to small church congregations. So huge diversity of engaged and passionate folks. And when I was going through, there's like a set standard set of reactions I get from every single one of those groups every single time. You know, so there's like four things that they'll bring up. They're like, HIV is all about this, 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 this. And it's the same four things they'll bring up every single time. And as I was sort of trying to figure out how to explain that to a general group, I realized as I was talking about, well, what do they say when I talk about injection drug users or black men or black women or this and that? And I guess I realized one of the things that I have commonly experienced that people in this room may or may not have experienced, you might find objectionable, you might think it's just totally wrong, and maybe it is that the responses I get are actually beyond what I would call stigma. And I wish I would say it was moving beyond stigma, but it's not. It's like stigma squared. It's like above and beyond stigma. And it's all too commonly a demonization of black men as the sole and fully ongoing responsible cause for HIV in the African-American community. And there can be multiple reasons. There's multiple reasons that come up. It's like almost like pick a reason. You know, it's because all HIV in the heterosexual community is clearly due to men on the down low. Or all HIV in the community is due to men coming back from prison. Or it's just a demonization for being gay and not meeting our expectations as a church or a family to what we wanted out of you. But in addition to that just being wrong and just being hurtful on an individual level and disempowering to individuals in our community, it also keeps us from getting where we need to get to in developing more detailed, more comprehensive, more insightful, and I think more meaningful responses to where we need to go. I tell straight men, straight black men, that actually, if you really are straight, and you actually haven't had sex with a guy, you don't have to worry about HIV, because only those bisexual men are men coming back from prison who get HIV. It tells, you know, it limits the conversations that we have about concurrent relationships, about condom use, about knowing your HIV status, because those are a lot more complicated, discussions. And it also, I think, limits our opportunity to get black men heavily involved in the response, proportionally involved in our prevention conversations, our prevention design, our strategic and our response, but also in our care and treatment response. You want to look at volume in our city among men. We have about 2,000 white gay men who've been diagnosed with HIV. We have about 1,600 black heterosexual men who've been diagnosed with HIV, non-drug using black heterosexual men. I can tell you the proportional participation is not the same. We're missing what we need as a stronger and a more welcoming and a more creative presence of a higher volume of black men in our response. So I put that out to this group, and I hope that, you know, that's an okay thing to put out there, because I think we really need to get creative on how we really address demonization, how we really move forward to embracing the future of what we need to do. So thank you for your patience.